You're listening to The Perth Property Show, Australia's only weekly property podcast by West Australian experts for West Australian listeners. Catch your latest episode every Monday at 7 a.m.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to The Perth Property Show. My name's Trent Fleskins, your host as always. This week, we're having a chat with the newly appointed president of UDIA WA, Richard Pappas, also the managing director of Celsius Property Group. He's been in before, but it's a poignant time to have a conversation about where things are at on the policy space. We haven't mentioned that so far in the first quarter of 2024. And also get a market update from one of Perth's most active built form apartment developers right now as to where things are at with his approvals and what the numbers look like with regards to getting this out of the ground in the first place. And finally, how long that's going to take and affect the market in a positive way. Richard, how you going, mate? Nice to see you again.
Good morning, Trent. Thanks for having me back.
Let's start the conversation with your appointment to UDIA president. First question I got to ask is, you're a busy man. Why'd you do it? Cole was a pretty busy guy himself.
Absolutely, yeah. Did I suspect when I joined UDIA Council 4.5 years ago that I would be president come October last year? Absolutely not. It's an exciting opportunity. It's an opportunity for me to give back to the industry. It's a great organization. It's got fantastic people. Tanya Steinbeck, CEO, has a fantastic team of really hardworking individuals that pull a lot together. But in addition to the team at UDI, there are over 100 volunteers that sit on the various committees that are feeding real data into every aspect of residential property, be it land, be it terraces, be it houses, be it townhouses. And so for me, that's really exciting. And to be afforded the opportunity to lead the organization, lead the council for a period of time is both humbling and challenging, but something that I'm certain will be very rewarding.
It'll be an exciting time for you when you think about the time you've had on the council. It probably gave you a lot of exposure to the advocacy side you may not have had as much exposure to beforehand, and now you're stepping it up to really be the figurehead along with the Property Council and REWA. It's really these three organisations that advocate for our industry. This body relies on you to represent everyone in that development space, as you said, and especially that built form space. And it's a very vibrant organisation. We've spoken to Tanya before. We've spoken to Cole Dutton, who preceded you as president, who's now moved on to be national president, which is something that I think as West Australians we should all be very proud of. It's a young organisation too in terms of its membership. You get a lot of young professionals who are really passionate about property. So to have someone like yourself who is just as passionate coming on the show, having these conversations, I think there'll be a lot of people listening today who would like to hear your thoughts on where things are at, both from a market perspective, from a development perspective, but also from something I'd like to segue into now, a policy advocacy perspective. What's on the radar for UDIA this year? What are you going to try and achieve? It's already been 3 months and it seems fairly quiet at the moment in terms of what's been going on since Christmas.
From an advocacy point of view, UDI has been very strong for a long period of time. We're known as collaborators. We really like to engage with all stakeholders, including government, in a collaborative way to be able to demonstrate with real facts and figures what we believe and what our members believe are some key things that can be done to improve ultimately supply. Because at the end of the day, in our current market, we need supply. The government would love us to produce instant supply. And I don't know how you do that from a property point of view. Mm-hmm. I think that the best way to achieve instant supply is to turn DA-approved site into sites that actually become under construction. That's as instant as I think we can make it in the development space. We've done some serious work with Western Power, which I'm immensely proud of the team.
Well, they've been a big bugbear for land developers and, to be frank, commercial developers alike for a couple of years now. They've really been the chokehold for a lot of us, haven't they?
Absolutely. I sat at a round table in October last year and there was a lot of frustration. To be fair, the frustration was on all sides. The ability to break that frustration down by holding regular meetings with all parties at the table to find solutions, to not point the finger, but to say, what can we do to ensure that we can assist Western Power to get approvals done in a more timely manner and to ensure we don't ever have a situation where someone has a house built and it cannot be energized. And I got to say that the last round table that we had in February of this year, the same consultants that were there in October stood up and congratulated Western Power for the turnaround that they have shown as an organization in terms of trying to do things in a different way and achieve a result in a more timely manner. So we're not there yet, but without a doubt, it proves that you can shift culture. And I'm not pointing the finger at Western Power with respect to culture. I'm saying we can all shift culture. And if we collaborate, if we meet together and work on solutions, we can achieve great outcomes.
It is a culture thing, not specifically with Western Power. I mean, I know some very high performing people at Western Power. It doesn't surprise me that they have the ability to transform their organization as it has needed to over the last couple of years when things have got quite dire. A lot out of their control as well. You think about even just at the design level, they lost so many designers, engineers in that space that really just didn't have the capacity to assist a market that was growing in the opposite direction as they were shrinking out of their own control. But to see that transformation is not only encouraging, but just critical, because you could solve every other problem if we could in this market. If you can't solve the energization, you can't turn the lights on at the end of the day.
Absolutely. So that's proven what we can do when industry meets with government agency and collaborates. And look, there are other agencies that we need to do the same with, not to point the finger, but to sit around the table and work out how can we do things better to make all of our lives a little bit easier. With the number one goal at stake is that we're in the middle of a housing crisis. We're heading to a state and federal election, and everyone is saying housing is the number one issue facing people. And so we owe it to the community to do better.
You're right. This is probably becoming really clear, even just over the last few weeks, that whilst there are other issues in the state, we've been speaking about ambulance ramping for a while. Last year, there's a lot of conversation about corrections facilities, hospitals in general. It really seems to be that the housing crisis has become the number one issue that everyone's talking about around the dinner table, on the news, political sense. Everyone needs to, I think, really just consider themselves part of the solution, part of a team, not adversarial, not gatekeepers, and simply pull together in a wartime-like situation and go, how can we work together to fix this? Let's put aside our ideology and let's just provide solutions to the biggest problem we've had in our generation.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that the government has made huge inroads in a plan in front. I think there's still plenty of work to do, but we're definitely headed in the right direction from a planning point of view and trying to get approvals through in a more timely manner. There is still some work to do in the design review phase from a built form project point of view, and we
too
can
much
talk
design
to
review. Is that the problem?
Too slow, I think, ultimately, and perhaps in some respects going around in circles, which adds a lot of time. That being said, in North Perth we got a lot of positivity out of some of the design review meetings that we had, and so there is definitely a function for design review.
It's horses for courses, I think, if we're talking about a landmark development like the one that you've got in North Perth, then of course it needs design review to an extent. If we're talking about a childcare centre or a shopping centre or something that's of commercial nature, does it really need to go through a design review for a functional asset? Probably not. That's time and money that's slowing up public services.
I think there's elements of that that are absolutely 100% correct. So there's planning, there's coming back to instant supply, there's ability for the government to expand on their infrastructure development fund, which they set up last year, which is a really great initiative whereby they offer to cover the headworks contribution for built form developments.
So this is essentially Water Corp, Western Power, NBN taxes for lay people listening.
Effectively headworks. So ultimately what we've established is the government allocated through Treasury $10,000 per dwelling if your project qualified. But what we found in practice is that actually the cost associated with that specific item was coming out at closer to $5,000. So we've spent some time working with the government in our pre-budget submission to look at expanding that. And before we went to government to look at expanding what could be considered for the Infrastructure Development Fund, we spent a lot of time surveying other built form developers about their projects, those that had been approved for the Infrastructure Development Fund but hadn't got off the ground. And it seemed to be that most projects were still not quite viable, even at $10,000. And so what we're calling for is for the fund to be expanded so that more items can be captured, things like land tax, building license fees, development application fees, public art contributions. So we're not talking about anything to do with actually building the roof over someone's head. They're all the extra charges that have crept in over a period of time.
Taxes and charges and fees, essentially. Absolutely. And these are the things we talk about, that 40% people continue to rattle off as the percentage of the cost of your house or apartment that is really just money going to the government in some form or fashion. What would you say to someone whose response to this development fund or even a broadening of the development fund is, well, all we're doing is lining the pockets of developers?
Well, what we're trying to do is we're trying to make developments that are not currently viable. And the reason we want to do that is because for a long time now, you and I have discussed my desire for Perth to maintain its affordability edge across other capital cities. And whilst that is very important, the truth is we have to get more expensive to get to a point where projects become viable, because construction costs ultimately have escalated far quicker than end values have escalated. And the time that developers have been caught holding land, trying to get approvals or even with approvals, adds further cost, additional land tax paid year on year, which makes a project even harder to stack up.
It's spiraling out of control in the opposite direction. So your argument essentially is, whilst this may be assisting developers to get these projects off the ground, they're not going to get off the ground if you don't get the assistance. And the assistance is really just mitigating the increased cost of the apartment that will be required anyway. So what it's actually doing is hopefully bringing the project forward, bringing the supply forward, but also hopefully keeping the cost down a little bit, essentially a lower threshold that a developer could get it moving and sell it to you for as a consumer.
Absolutely. And if you look at North Perth as an example, 104 apartments, if we can get that project up and running and out of the ground, then not only does that produce 104 one, two, and three bedroom apartments in North Perth, but it also affords people sitting in their house, their character house, their family home that they've sat there for a number of years, the opportunity to move out of that home, which creates an opportunity for someone else to move into that home and perhaps move their kids into the school at the same time. So that's just one practical example. Ultimately, North Perth will get there from a
North
development
Perth probably
occurring.
Not the big issue, is it? It's probably not, other suburbs like Morley, Bayswater, Cannington, these sort of suburbs that really are years away, aren't they?
Well, absolutely. Look, I think whether North Perth gets there straight away in 1 or 2 years' time might be the difference between the expansion of the Infrastructure Development Fund. But we're looking at suburbs beyond North Perth. We know that we can make developments work in Subiaco. We can make developments work in Claremont and City Beach and the western suburbs. And that's great. That's really important. We have to do that. But we have to look beyond that, and we have to look to the Victoria Parks and the Bayswater, Dianella, and those suburbs. Median house prices are not quite there yet, but they will get there, and this fund just helps to bring forward the ability to develop in those areas sooner rather than later, and hopefully provide more product, more housing, more supply, which means less rental stress.
Well, let's talk about rental stress for a minute. We are in a chokehold. There are thousands, tens of thousands of people in a chokehold at the moment, stuck in the rental market, who have seen an 80% rise in their rents over the last 5 years, looking to get to a point where they can save enough of a deposit to be able to get into the median house price property in their suburb. Have spent the last couple of years watching those sales prices run away from them. The deposit they've saved, $10,000 this year, for example, is now another $20,000 behind where it needs to be. Surely an advocacy point that the UDIA should be pushing for is to help people get out of the rental market as quick as possible. And that would be to index this bloody first home buyer's rate of duty from where it is at 430 to just where the median house price is today, currently up in the high 500s. Why isn't the Treasurer looking at this as an option?
That's a fair point, Trent, and something that we should look at. And I think it's really important that at the end of the day, industry bodies like UDIA collaborate with PCA and RERA, and that we get on the same page in terms of what we're asking for. Mm. And I think providing the opportunity for tenants to buy their own home, as you say, brings them out of a rental property, generally speaking, and creates a rental property for somebody else.
Well, for a construction worker, we need to immigrate here.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
That's the crux of it. When we think about this self-fulfilling cycle right now, this nearly this evil self-fulfilling cycle, people are against immigration if it means that it's going to hold them back from buying their property. But the only way we're actually going to solve the problem of the capacity issue we have on building the amount of properties we need in Perth every year to service the amount of people we already have is we need more people to pick up a trowel. Now, it's either going to come from their existing population, which doesn't seem to be happening, or it's going to come from very selective immigration. And if it does come from immigration, those people are going to need to live somewhere, and generally that's the rental market. If they can't get into the rental market because our own people are clogging it up because they can't afford the $25,000 stamp duty cost that now exists between the old median house price of $430 and the current one of $590, soon to be $600, then a simple solution to fix that is update the first homeowner's rate of stamp duty. It sounds very simple to me, especially with a budget surplus in the billions.
Yep, they absolutely can work on that. And what they have done from a built form space is they have introduced some stamp duty relief for product under construction, for built form product under construction. So I think that definitely helps. It certainly goes a long way to trying to equalize the opportunity behind someone buying a house and land package versus choosing to buy an apartment or some sort of strata title product. So I think that's definitely a step in the right direction.
I think it helps people, obviously, who are looking to buy an apartment. But as we've just pointed out, there are no options for an apartment in Canning Vale or in Coburn Central or in Dianella. Even if they wanted to buy an apartment, there just are no projects that are close to stacking up there. So it really only does support those people who have the ability to pay $750,000, $800,000, $1 million for a two-bedroom apartment in Subiaco, for example.
Oh, look, I think that the benefit of trying to create built-form projects that have diversity in products so that we can bring in potentially some studio apartments, some one-bedroom apartments, is to bring a more affordable entry point into suburbs that otherwise would be unaffordable for either first home buyers or even just young professionals. So I think diversity of product into buildings, ensuring that we can capitalize on the fact that downsizers can afford to pay a premium price for a premium product of big size, is really important. That we do try to accommodate also smaller product as well in those developments. And the reality is it's hard to do because at the end of the day, they are the ones that don't really stack up from a construction cost. But we have to provide a diverse mix of product into the market.
So to summarize on the advocacy space, if we get to the end of the year, we're chatting at Christmas, end of 2024, what would be the three things on the list that if you got those things through or approved or changed, updated, introduced, you'd be really proud of and go, that was a good year?
From a built form point of view, I think the expansion of the Infrastructure Development Fund is a no-brainer to try and assist tackle instant supply in the built form space and ensure we are trying to become a denser city. We do also need to look at the medium term and the long term so that we don't find ourselves in this position again. There is some advocacy that we're doing on enabling infrastructure to bring new greenfield subdivisions to market in the medium term, and that is in multiple corridors so that we are thinking about how do we create the next block of supply, and that's not going to be for today or for tomorrow, but it's going to be for the medium term.
So we're talking about getting our drainage, sewer, wastewater pumping station, all these things,
all that major infrastructure
forward, so that we're not caught on the back foot again.
100%. We need to ensure that the agencies are aligned with what the government wants to do from a planning point of view, from a future planning point of view. So I think enabling infrastructure is a very important part. At the end of the day, we need built form, but we also need house and land packages because that is the most affordable product that we can bring to market at the current point in time. So I think that's really important. And I think that continuing to shift culture within agencies. So if we can work on certainly environment is another one,
that's a massive one. You slipped that one in there, Richard, but it seems to be on the terrace right now. The conversation is there. Everyone is having a big problem with DEWA's EPA team.
And from what I understand, the government again is definitely looking at that, making inroads in very similar fashion to what we've seen with Western Power. And I think there should be no reason why we can't replicate what we are currently doing with Western Power on all sides with DEWA and environment. And I think that would be a huge tick, and that is another opportunity to create the supply in a relatively quick period of time.
I agree. And as we said before, you can have every other part of the system working, but if one of these parts holds up the developer, holds them to ransom essentially, that's time and risk and cost that just makes it even harder to get this thing to market the 2 or 3 years later than they planned to get it to market. And the EPA team at DEWA is one of those consulting phases that can just go on forever, hold you to ransom essentially, and is currently overreaching, in my opinion, on their remit, especially when it comes to the house and land industry.
Yeah, there's definitely work that can be done there. The government is working hard. They've just set up a new growth housing unit within Treasury that will hold all the agencies accountable. And there are some great people that have gone into that unit to support how we can make things more efficient and how we can effectively simplify the rules and ultimately get things done in a more timely fashion.
Those three things, I think, if you got to the end of the year, and not only UDIA, but PCA and REWA have worked together to get these three core themes sorted out, I should say, in this industry, it starts to, again, de-wrinkle what is quite a complex and risky environment, not to mention an environment that already exists in high interest rates and high cost escalation to deliver these blocks of land or apartments in a place like North Perth.
And I think ultimately our success will be where we see that these substantial escalations in rental values and substantial escalations in median house prices start to pare back a bit. And then we will know that we've got sufficient supply into the market. That, for me, is a big tick. And I think at the same time, whilst we talk about advocacy, I think we also owe it to the community to work really on education. I think industry bodies have a role to play in educating the community about who we are and what we do. We're everyday people. We're not this big, bad, greedy developer that's just doesn't really care about the community. community. In fact, I've just spent a number of days down south with UDI State Conference. I've been over in Melbourne with the National Conference, and it's just fantastic to spend time, particularly over in Melbourne with the WA contingent. I think there was close to 40 people that attended, and we're doing a great job. Let me tell you that at the National Awards last week, WA Projects took out a 4 of 11 project awards, including the best of the best project, which was a sustainable development down in Wycliffe. And yeah. So I think One Subiaco, the sustainable development down in Wycliffe, Curtin University and Henley Brook by Mervac all took out national awards. And we should be very proud of that. And we need to trumpet that to the community. We need our members of the community to understand that we do a great job in Western Australia in property development.
Well, not only property development, we think about everything that we do in Western Australia, even if it's the cricket, for example, the basketball. Most things, when it starts here, we always punch above our weight, and we should be proud of that, and we should continue to be Team WA when it comes to delivering for ourselves across the nation. Let's segue into the second part of this conversation and talk to Richard Pappas, Celsius Property Group, more specifically about what you're doing at Celsius, because I want to get an update from a fella who is right there with his hands in the mud as a perfect case study for what's going on the ground in trying to provide supply right now. You're not only in built form, you've also got some land development going there too. So let's maybe start with the land development. It's probably the easiest one to talk about quickly. You've got a couple of projects going.
We decided to get into the land space when Brenton Downing joined our organization, and he has been an expert in land for a number of years. We were fortunate enough to pick up a site in Piara Waters, just off Warden Road, adjacent to the pub. That's, you know, a relatively small land subdivision, but still carries, I think, 84 lots. The growth in that precinct has been phenomenal. We would still consider that to be a middle ring in terms of the location.
Piara Waters, middle ring.
Middle ring, without a doubt, middle ring. And the buyers there are absolutely localized. We've just completed the sales of stage one. Title should issue in May of this year. We're about to start construction of stage two. And I would say 90% of the buyers have come from within a 3 kilometre radius, and they are either upgrading or downsizing.
Southern River, Harrisdale, Canyon Vale, these sort of places.
Absolutely. And prices have lifted in that location, without a doubt. People are passionate. That's where they want to live. It's a great area. Not just does it have a pub nearby, but there's a new IGA that's opened up with a little shopping precinct. That really means that, once again, you've got walkable amenity to the subdivision. And for us at Celsius, coming from a built form space, I think that the community that we develop in is really important. We've been really happy with the progress that our first land subdivision is on track to have titles issue, if not in May, then certainly in June this year.
Have you dealt with any of those issues we spoke about when it comes to Western Power, getting contractors, time frames? Have you delivered on time with regards to your timeline? Has it pushed out a little further?
Look, our time frame has been pretty aligned. We were a little bit slow from a planning approval point of view, but I don't think that we have anyone to blame with respect to that. Learning about Western Power from my point of view with a real life project has been really great. And so seeing that experience firsthand and seeing how things can change and improve has been fantastic. We're certainly happy with how Piara Waters has progressed. We also have purchased a piece of land in Champion Lakes. We actually purchased that before Piara Waters. It's probably been a more challenging one to get to market just based on the median house price of the surrounding suburbs.
Well, and we think about Armidale. The city of Armidale has been seeing nation-leading growth over the last 12 months, 30, 40% growth in some of these suburbs. That certainly has to have helped you get this project to market.
Absolutely. I think at the end of the day, what we're seeing now is people who could have bought a slightly older 3x2 or 4x2 for probably low 400,000s. I mean, that price is probably $600,000 now, maybe even a little bit more. And they're looking at that and saying, well, there's very little product, established product on the market. So there's almost no choice. The price at which they are having to bid to try and secure established home is beyond what they feel is comfortable. And all of a sudden, buying a block of land and going through a build, even if it is going to take a bit longer than they would like, gives them what they want in terms of design and new product. They're not competing on the market, and it's probably not costing them anymore. So I think that what we're seeing there is a snippet as what we will see in the built form space in years to come. Ultimately, the established market will get to a point where projects are viable once again.
We're just starting to see that in land. It was only 9 months ago that I was chatting with Brendan Ptolemy, for example, and the answer was still, we're not really seeing a lot of movement still. Cole Dutton, for example, it still wasn't really there yet. It's only been maybe the last 6 months that the land market has really started to pick back up again. East Coast investors have led the way, and now finally local owner occupiers are going, well, look, the established market really has picked up to a point where I may as well have a conversation about building my own home again, because it just wasn't a conversation for the last two or so years. Probably one, because of a lack of trust in the build industry. Two, because a lot of those buyers were just vacuumed forward with the build grant anyway. And three, because there just wasn't a parity of price between the established and the new build, because the new, as you said before, the cost of the new build has risen so much faster than the established market or end value market. So we're finally getting to parity again now, which will help to see a bit more supply coming on. But I guess the thing we're limited on is not the intent for new supply, it's still the capacity to provide new supply. We are in that infill land development space ourselves, and it really has changed over the last, I'd say, 6 months. All of the civil contractors are absolutely bursting at the seams when it comes to their workloads. We're at capacity.
Yeah, we are. And I think we've learned a lot from COVID and the stimulus era. So I really do believe that builders will be more cautious in terms of how many builds that they take on. And I think there is a huge push. Everyone is trying really hard to attract more skilled labor to town. And I don't just mean from a migration point of view. I think that from an apprenticeship point of view, there's never been a better time. I truly believe there's never been a better time for young people to take up an apprenticeship. Pay is very good. We're going to need people working a trade for a long period of time. And working a trade is an opportunity to end up anywhere. And there have been some very prominent builders that have started on a trade.
Well, we think about the biggest ones in Perth. They were started on the trade, didn't
Correct.
They?
Yeah.
Let's move to your built form space. This is where historically you've been the most active. Now, you've had a pipeline for a few years of projects. As we know, it takes years to get these things off the ground and then get them out of the ground. Let's start with the most recent approval. I guess you're pretty happy with yourself and pretty excited, pretty relieved. Build to rent in Shenton Park.
Yes, absolutely.
Congratulations, mate.
Thank you, Trent. Yeah, look, that's a huge opportunity. DevWA, award-winning precinct, Montara Quarter. We've got a development there that is made up of a built-to-rent development and a built-to-sell development. They are fully
integrated. So two towers.
Fully integrated, but side by side. The built-to-rent development is 13 stories. It underpins the corner at the roundabout. It'll have fantastic views back to the city. It's a very walkable amenity. It's on the doorstep to the hospital precinct, where there are a significant number of key workers, and it will carry circa 230 apartments, of which just over 50% will be studio and one bedroom apartments. And if you think about in the western suburbs, when was the last time any form of new product was built that carried a substantial number of one or two bedroom apartments?
Well, it didn't. There it is didn't. None.
And ultimately, they've been sold entirely to own occupiers, and yet there is a huge cohort of professional tenants that want to live and can afford to live in a location like that, that are starved from opportunity. So we're very excited about that opportunity. There's still plenty of work to do with respect to documentation. We have right alongside it a built-to-sell development that is 8 stories in height and about 72 apartments. It sits on the park front with a northern orientation, and we're certain that that will offer the most premium opportunity for north-facing apartments in that precinct. And the demand still amongst own occupiers for quality product in the western suburbs has never been greater.
I want to get nerdy for a sec with regards to delivering a project of this size. I'm assuming it's, from my understanding, the biggest project you will deliver to date. Where do you get the money for a build-to-rent project like this? That, from my calculations, build-to-rent is a pretty hard one to make work when it comes to yields, and it's essentially a very big residential development, obviously, that you're holding as a passive hold. We know up until recent history, normal finances want you to sell these things. They don't want you holding it. They don't want the saturation risk of being the biggest investor in one apartment building. So just from a nerdy perspective, where do you get the money for a project like this? It's not coming from the big guys, is it?
No, ultimately, it's an institution or a sovereign wealth fund that will own the asset for the long term.
Like a pension fund or something?
Yeah, absolutely. Pension funds, superannuation funds. You've only got to look to the US, to the UK, to Europe to see how big the built-to-rent market is in those spaces. And we've started to see some considerable built-to-rent come out of the ground on the East Coast. We're still very proud of the fact that the very first built-to-rent project completed in Australia was Sentinel's project in Subiaco. When I was in Melbourne last week, I visited Sentinel's second project called Briscoe in Melbourne. I also visited Mervac's project. And so there are developments occurring in the built-to-rent space, but it does require very patient money. And that patient money does exist, but it exists in that sovereign wealth fund, institution, super fund space.
People who are looking for a fairly low risk return, bond level return, aren't we? That's sort of what we're talking about with these sort of projects. So you'll be developing it and then handing it over, essentially pre-selling it to a sovereign wealth fund and then managing it.
Ultimately, that's exactly right. And we would look after it just like we look after the strata / facility management of any other building that we've created, and just like we look after the property management of over 400 units that mums and dads have bought. And so this is just an opportunity to create rental product at scale. And you will recall that since January 2021, the number of bonds held online reduced by over 20,000. That's 20,000 mum and dad investors that chose to sell their investment property as the market improved, and in every instance, sold to an own occupier. And yes, we've seen a lot of East Coast activity in more recent times, the last couple of years, but that has been highly targeted at house and land packages in the greenfield subdivision areas. And that's positive. It is providing supply, but we need rental supply in the near city suburbs, just like Shenton Park.
We really do. Let's move on to North Perth. This is a project that I've had a keen interest in, living and working just down the road. I was disgusted, to be frank, by the level of NIMBYism in North Perth. The people who live around the corner, down the road, who made your life pretty hard to get this thing up in the first place, at what is a site that, to be frank, should already have an apartment development on it and would be lucky to have one going forward, especially one to the quality that you were proposing in the first place. You got this thing approved finally after a couple of attempts last year, to my glee and obviously to many people in the industry who are very excited to see a project like this get up. It will be a landmark project in the area with phenomenal views and will add so much to the high street on Fitzgerald Street. I'm very excited about seeing it. Can you walk us through a little bit of the realities of the timeline, for example, of when, just to give the listenership a little bit of context about the journey in a apartment developer goes on from first putting some money down the site, then what goes through all the planning space, when you expect we'll actually have people opening their doors and moving in?
It's been a journey, that's for sure, Trent. And look, I think I'd start by saying that, like anything, we're all learning along the way and we all make mistakes. And on reflection, I think that what we had initially proposed on the basis of what we were seeing approved in other, what we thought was like-minded suburbs or similar suburbs, was not going to be supported in that location. We started looking at that land probably in 2017. We bought the first parcel circuit in 2018. So it's been a long journey. We lodged an approval for two towers, 13 stories in 11, and we were refused at JDAP, and we went back to the drawing boards. And when you put your blood, sweat, and tears into creating a development scheme, I mean, we were gutted because we truly believed that that was a fantastic scheme for the community, for the location, and quite sympathetic to the surrounding areas.
And it gave a lot back on the ground floor and the first couple of floors in terms of that activation with the street and commercial property and all those sort of things.
It did, absolutely. And so I thought, and a lot of people thought, wow, what are these guys going to do now? And our architects, Space Collective, were tasked with a big challenge of how do you turn what is two buildings or 13 and 11 into something that is not quite as tall, but more bulky.
Which always seems to happen through the planning process, squashing it down.
Into something that we're still going to be very proud of. And I have to say, we've had people within the industry and within the community come to us and say, you know what, we were madly in love with what you were creating, but we can't believe that we actually love what you're doing now even more. And that's full credit to the architects. I did touch on it before. The process that you go through from a designer review point of view can be quite timely. It was certainly took a considerable amount of time with regard to our Shenton Park project. The feedback that we got out of the North Perth design reviews, a lot of that was quite constructive. And there were definitely some improvements to our project that were made. But ultimately, it takes a long time and a lot of concessions to get to a point of approval. And I think that ultimately, that's not necessarily the fault of anybody, any individual. We need to do planning more proactively. We need to update our schemes on a more regular basis. We can't leave it to the developer to lead the discussion about increasing density in 2023.
Because the finger gets pointed at the developer for skirting the rules, for example.
Absolutely. Whereas if we update our schemes on a more regular basis, and government and local government is definitely trying to do that, then we will probably find that there will be less venting at a specific developer and more taking the community on a journey to let them know that actually height in a location like that isn't bad. In fact, it's very good and it's the perfect place to put a bit of height.
In this location, it's saving blocks 100 metres, 200, 300 metres inside the suburb from needing that height, because we inevitably need the density. So you're either going to put it on the high street away from the mums and dads' houses, or everyone's just going to be two or three storey triplex blocks. Which one do you want?
We need to maintain that greenery through our suburbs. In particular, our near city suburbs are full of beautiful trees that we should do everything we can to preserve. Fragmented ownership is also a very big challenge. And so when you do find an opportunity to amalgamate what invariably was five sites into just under 5,000 square meters of land, then I think there is an opportunity for planning to lead a bit more than what occurred with respect to our development. Having said that, I've got a lot of respect for the City of Vincent's planning staff because they went on a journey with us and their life was incredibly difficult too. And we are very proud of what we've achieved.
And look, I've spoken very recently to leaders in the local government space who have said off their own accord, why is it so hard for us to change our local planning scheme? It is too hard. We go through the same issues that developers do. The process is truncated and slowed down at the DPLH level with regards to all the agencies that we need to speak to. We're going through the same things, Trent. It's just as hard for us. I wish we could update our schemes quicker, but we get held up by the state government side for years. Imagine the frustration there. So we're pointing the fingers as developers at the city. The city's saying, well, we're getting screwed around by the state. The state says, well, how many things do you want us to fix at once? It's a big circular situation. It will never be perfect, but it just shows that it really isn't just one party holding everyone up. There's generally a number of reasons, and it's quite a circular nature.
Absolutely. And look, at the end of the day, we have an incredibly energetic planning and housing minister who wants to make a big difference and is doing a really great job. And we have housing top of list with respect to both state and federal election. And so if there's ever a time that we can share information with authenticity with the government to say these are some of the things that we can do collectively in a collaborative way to make everyone's life a bit easier and the net result is more supply, we owe it to ourselves to have our sleeves rolled up and to be doing that day in, day out until we get it right.
So you first engaged on and purchased one of these blocks in 2018. When are you going to be finishing the sales of these at some point in time?
Well, we're hoping to start the local marketing probably in a couple of months, but it won't be till July or August that we'll get a sales office up. Our program has us starting construction sometime in the first quarter of next year, which is 2025. It's realistically a two-year build, but you've got to add 3 to 6 months to that by the time you finish it, get through practical completion, do your defects, attend your buyer inspections, make sure everyone's happy. And so realistically, middle of 2027.
So we're talking 10 years. This is a decade-long journey for you, Richard, to get this landmark project up.
That's like almost all of primary school and high school. It's a long time.
It is, right? So hopefully that for anyone who's listening who is interested in learning more about that relationship and how much love and passion. You don't do this if you're not passionate about it, right? You don't spend 10 years on one of these projects, let alone the three or four you've got going on at the same time without being passionate about the outcomes, right?
No,
and
I mean, look.
It certainly isn't just for the money, because if it was, there'd be many easier things you could be doing right now.
Yes, that's 100% correct. Yeah, and my daughter who's just turned 17, she wants to know when it's going to be finished because she can't wait to live in an apartment in North Perth. I've managed her expectations that it's not going to be one of the penthouses.
Richard Pappas, thank you so much for your time, mate. It's been a really enlightening conversation from you both as the president of the UDIA to understand where you're at with regards to advocacy, but also just as a leading developer in Western Australia these days to understand some realities about what's going on, what is working, what's not working, and what you hope to achieve over the next couple of years. Mate, thank you very much. Fingers crossed for this state on finding some more solutions to add supply, supply, supply.
Well, thanks, Trent, and thanks for shining a light on our industry in a very positive manner.
Thanks, mate.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Perth Property Show. If you've only just joined the conversation, you can catch up by heading over to our website, perthpropertyshow.com.au, subscribing to the podcast, or joining our Facebook page. Don't forget to tune in next Monday at 7 a.m. for more expert insights, local analysis, and suburb spotlights. Happy hunting!